your Chanukah should be very rewarding. I just want to begin. I will have some things about the Chavos HaLevavos we're still dealing with. But I do just want to mention one very important pivotal thought of the Maharal. The Maharal has a wonderful sefer on Chanukah, the Ner Mitzvah. It's a short sefer, but a very difficult sefer in many ways. But the Maharal raises a very important point, a very critical point. And he says, why did Chazal enact a holiday of Chanukah? Why do we have a holiday of Chanukah? So 9 out of 10 people, maybe 99 out of 100 people, would say it's a commemoration of the miracle of the Pach HaShemen, in which there was a jar of oil that was found when we regained the Beis HaMikdash, and the oil would only burn one day, and miraculously it burned 7 more days. So we have a miracle, we have a chag rather, to commemorate a miracle. The Maharal points out that that logically cannot be the case. We don't create Yomim Tovim just to celebrate miracles. I mean, let's take, for example, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa was a great tzaddik, and he was also very poor. And you may recall the story that one time his wife only had vinegar to light Shabbos candles. Vinegar doesn't burn. And Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa said, light the vinegar, because the same Hashem that says oil can burn can also make vinegar burn. Another time a snake bit him and the snake died. So why don't we have a Chanina ben Dosa day? You know, he had miracles. If anything, vinegar burns. The answer is miracles are miracles, but you don't make a chag when there's a miracle. You make a chag when Klal Yisrael has been saved from something. That is when you make a chag. Geula. So the Maharal says the reason why Chazal made the holiday of Chanukah was not because of the nes of the Pach HaShemen. They made the holiday of Chanukah to commemorate the victory over the Yevanim that was trying to destroy us, take us away from Torah. It represented the idea that Hashem gave us a Yeshua of delivering the many into the hands of the few, the impure in the hands of the pure, to give us the ability to serve Torah, and above all, to dedicate the Beis HaMikdash. Indeed, Chanukah means dedication of the Beis HaMikdash. That's what it means. Chanukah Fe is a later little drash that says, but Chanukah means dedication. So the holiday of Chanukah is about rededication of the Beis HaMikdash and the ability to serve Hashem. It is not about the nes of the Pach HaShemen, and that is why the Al HaNisim prayer in Shemona Esrei, which expresses gratitude to Hashem, does not mention the miracle of the oil. It does mention they lit Neros, but that just refers to the normal lighting of the menorah. That is not a reference to any miracle. So the Maharal then says, so why do we light candles? Why do we remember that miracle? The Maharal says, it's not because that's why we have the holiday, but it puts the holiday in perspective. Because here is what happens. If all we were to do would be commemorate our great victory, we theoretically could have attributed it to our own strength. As the Torah warns over and over again, a person's attitude might be, Kochi v'yotzim yadi, it is my strength, it is my power that has given me victory. So we remember the miracle, which was clearly a supernatural intervention beyond the laws of nature, so that we will understand that kashem, that the burning of the oil was supernatural and could only be effected by the Yad Hashem, so too our victory and our ability to dedicate the Beis HaMikdash came from Hashem. You need the open supernatural miracle to understand that even the normal operation of life and certainly the extraordinary military victories also come from Hashem. So the Maharal says, the Pach HaShemen is not the reason for Chanukah, but it is the vehicle that puts the Geula of Chanukah into the proper perspective. That's a very, very important idea. And this answers a lot of questions. This answers, number one, why in the Al HaNisim, which is about gratitude to Hashem, we don't express gratitude for the miracle of the Pach HaShemen? The Maharal's answer is because the gratitude of Chanukah is connected to our ability to vanquish Yavan that tried to destroy us, not physically, spiritually. And that's a remez that b'chol dor v'dor, Hashem will give us the koach that our light can vanquish the darkness. It also answers another question. You know, the most famous question of Hanukkah is, why is Hanukkah an eight-day holiday? If they found enough oil for one day, then the miracle is for another 7 days. So Hanukkah should only be 7 days, starting from the second day, right? From the second day through the eighth day. So there are, this is the Beis Yosef's kasha, actually, and there are at least 500 answers to this question, because I've seen Svarim that give you 500 answers to this question. I cannot say I know all 500 answers, and I wouldn't tell you all of them if I did. But the Maharal says, according to his pshat, you have a very simple answer. The eight-day celebration of Hanukkah is not in commemoration of the Neros. It is because Chanukah Sabayis, the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash, is always done in eight-day increments. In the Midbar, the Mishkan was essentially dedicated over 8 days. 7 days at the end of Adar, and Rosh Chodesh Nisan was the eighth day. And that's connected Kabbalistically to the idea that eight is above nature. Seven is the repetitive cycle of time. Eight is above nature. God's relationship to the Jewish people is above nature. We celebrate eight, but it's not because of the nace of the Pach HaShemen per se. Now, a related answer, though, which is not the Maharal's answer, but it ties into the idea that miracles put life in perspective. The word nace means a banner or a flag. A flag calls your attention to things. The world often operates as if God is not there. The world often operates with the illusion of things just happening by the laws of nature, by coincidence, by political intrigue. By the way, in my neighborhood, if you go by the kever of Shimon HaTzadik, our friends to the east put up a nice sign in English saying, "This is no longer Israeli territory by UN resolution. Citizens of Israel are not welcome here." That's what I said, you know. But once again, so, you know, you read these types of idiocies and you kind of think that the world is run by the United Nations, by the U.S. government, etc., by nature, by earthquakes, by tsunamis. The world is a world of very often hester upon him. God conceals. But every once in a while, HaKadosh Baruch Hu lifts up the veil. So you see Hashem is in charge. But the Ramban writes, it's not just he's in charge then, it's to remind you that he is the architect and he is the conductor of all that happens. Again, this is certainly the Chavos HaLevavos Shita, that there's nothing that happens to anybody, any Jew certainly, that is not directly determined by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, in effect, the difference between nature and miracle is only a question of perception. We look at nature as if it's autonomous, although God could intervene, but if God doesn't intervene, it just goes on. And we look at miracle as God's direct intervention. But in reality, the miracle is designed to teach you what nature is. Right? That's what the Ramban writes. That's why it's called the nes. It's called a flag. Mimela, some answer very simple. Why is Hanukkah 8 days? The miracle is only 7 days. The answer is no. The miracle is even when oil burns normally. Don't think the miracle is only the supernatural. Life is the miracle. Everything is a nes in the sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hashkacha pratis on everything. And that's what Rav Chanina ben Daisa said. He who commanded the vinegar, the oil to burn, can command the vinegar to burn. Oil burning normally is a miracle as well. And we say in the Shemone Esrei three times a day, Al Nisecha Shebechol Yom Imanu, the miracles that surround us every single moment, every single second of our lives. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Hashkacha Pratis. This certainly is the sheet of the Chavos HaLevavos. We went through some other views on this, but this is what he espouses in the Shar HaBitachon. And the Chassam Sofer says very beautifully that this idea that Teva itself is an unfolding of God's Hashkacha Pratis is the meaning of a passage in Ma'oz Tzur. Right? Everyone sings Ma'oz Tzur. although I have to say that although I also use the traditional niggun, but one needs to know if you're a musician that the traditional niggun is actually taken from a Bavarian drink song. But okay, be it as it may, even the chol can be niskadesh. We can take everything and we can elevate it and make it kadesh. But Mo's sur, if you follow it, is really describing that the Mechaber was Mordechai, not the Mordechai of Purim, obviously, but much later. And each stanza begins with a letter of his name, and the last one is Chazak. And each one describes how Hashem redeems us from a different tribulation. The first one is a general idea that Hashem takes care of us. And then we have Mitzrayim, which is Ra'os. And then we have Babylonia. And then we have Persia, which is Haman. Then we have Yevanim, which is Hanukkah. That's next to the last. And the last one, which over the years was heavily censored. So that's why if your family are using different Siddurim, everybody might say different words. The last stanza in particular is all messed up because it referred to the downfall of Rome, which is the Catholic Church, and everything else. And in the Middle Ages, there was heavy censorship in the last stanza. But the next to the last stanza is really the Hanukkah one. Yevanim, Nikvatsu alai, right? The Yevanim tried to destroy me, tried to gather against me. And it mentions at the end that we found that little pach of shemen, and it says, B'nei bina yemei shimona kavu shir urinanim. B'nei bina, the children of bina, of understanding, made Hanukkah for 8 days. Now, why does the Mechaber use the word bina? Why bina? Now you could answer, well, Bina rhymes with Shmona, and you know that may be a good reason. But the Chassam Sofer says the following. All of us know the difference between Chachma and Bina. Chachma is the knowledge that you acquire. Bina, by the way, of which women are blessed with Bina Yesera, Bina is the capacity to be Maven Davar Mitoch Davar. From what you already know, you can extrapolate, you can apply it to a new situation. Says the Chassam Sofer, a Chacham would have made Hanukkah only 7 days. He sees a miracle that the oil should have burnt for 1 day, and it burnt for 8 days. I see a 7-day miracle. But a Maven understands from the miracle that even the normal process is a hashgacha pratis. So b'nei bina yemei shimona, they make Hanukkah 8 days. The chacham would have made it 7 days. The maven makes it 8 days. And that's really our perspective on life, to understand that life is a miracle. And again, as the Chavos Halevavos says, this is his shita, l'chol hapachas, and this is a shita that's been very, very mekubal among Am Yisrael. Although again, we looked at other perspectives, and that is that everything that happens to us is from the hand of a loving God that cares about us, that nurtures us, that gives us what we need, even when things are very, very difficult and very dark. Again, any mature person understands, as the Chazon Ish writes, that bitachain does not mean everything is going to be easy. Very, very critical. It doesn't mean there will not be suffering. It does not mean there will not be tragedies. We know, unfortunately, that that's not the case. We know there is suffering. We know there is tragedies. We know that things don't always have a simple, let's say, Pollyannish type of ending. Although, Baruch Hashem, many times they in fact do, but often not. But that's not a contradiction to bitachon. Bitachon is not the idea that everything will be the way I want it to come out. No. Right? If that would be so, that would be a false idea of bitachon, and that would be an immature conception of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But it does mean that everything ultimately is there for me to learn something from, to grow from, to become better, to become closer to Hashem, and in many, many ways, it is Gamzu L'Tova. And the Chavos Halevavos himself, I'm sorry.
The Shita, okay, that everything, God controls everything, but there's another Shita you mentioned about free will.
Yes, I mentioned the Orach Chaim in this week's Parsha, yeah.
It's free will.
And you talked about it.
Sort of.
I'll repeat it, yeah.
No, then how come Hakol HaTovah, or God controls everything, there's sort of a contradiction.
Well, there's, according to the... you're correct. I mean, if you put aside the Orach Chaim, the way the Chovas HaLevavos explains it. Yeah. Remember, the Chovas HaLevavos has a very complicated structure. Yeah. Every person has free will, mm-hmm. but the person with free will cannot harm another person unless Hashem decreed. So what would happen is the following. Yeah. Reuven decides to kill Shimon, so Hashem will match them up so that Reuven will kill Shimon. If Reuven would decide not to kill Shimon, that very second, the Chovas HaLevavos says Shimon would die from some other reason. So what happens to a person is only from Hashem, but the human instrumentality who chooses to do the Aveira, that's his own Bechira.
And everybody...
The Orach Chaim would disagree. The Orach Chaim... Well, you're correct. Like the Orach Chaim, Gamzu L'Tova is harder to understand. I agree that it's a little bit difficult. But it still could be understood on a deeper level, and that is, even if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not the architect of the negative decision, the fact that he allowed it to happen and didn't stop it, that's also a Gamzu L'Tova by the Eibishter's omission. Because remember, even like the Orach Chaim, Hashem can always intervene and stop something. So there's still a decision, at least passively, by Hashem not to step in. Okay, but it's a different, it is a little different. But again, where we're focusing primarily, today at least, on the Chovas HaLevavos Shita, as I say, this seems to be the one that's more mekubal among Am Yisrael and Gedolei Yisrael, really for hundreds and hundreds of years. Now, the Chovas HaLevavos himself discusses a lot of these basic questions, and that is, if everything is from God, everything's from Hashem, then we're back to the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Right? Why do tzaddikim suffer? Why do Rishoyim prosper? Hashem is omnipotent, he's all-powerful, Hashem is all-knowing, Hashem has rachamim, and Hashem loves those who are righteous and keep his will. So why shouldn't they have, only that which is good? And the Chovas HaLevavos, now of course keep in mind, this Chovas HaLevavos is not the first person who asked this question. At a minimum, it is at least as old as Moshe Rabbeinu himself. When Moshe Rabbeinu asked Hashem, Hodieni na esterachecha, show me your ways. The Gemara in Brachos says, he wanted to understand, why do tzaddikim suffer in this world? And why do Rishoyim prosper? And Hashem didn't answer the question. Hashem told him, V'chanaisi eis asher achon, I will be compassionate to whom I choose to be compassionate. V'richamti eis asher rachem, I will choose to be merciful to whom I choose to be merciful. I mean, I'm not telling you. And ever since then, we never have really had a definite answer. There are many possibilities, and the truth is there is no one answer. Number one, we have to know that ultimately the scales of divine justice are beyond our comprehension. Number two, we do believe that in Olam Haba L'chol HaPachos everything gets fixed up. But still, we don't really understand what is going on here. So the Chovas HaLevavos makes a number of critical points that, again, other Svarim elaborate as well. And that is, number one, there's a possibility of Gilgal. Sometimes a person suffers in this world because of the sins of a past life. Lahavgal mea havdalas, Buddhism says exactly that. But again, the Mekubalim did believe in reincarnation, although Chazal do not mention it. Number two, but this is very important. The idea that there has to be evil in the world is a necessary mechanism for facilitating Bechira. Why is that so? Let's imagine we had a world that worked exactly the way we think it works. Every time you do good, you get $1 million. And every time you do an Aveira, you get an electric shock that graduates to a higher level as you repeat the offense. Now, if you recall, you have Pavlov, you have a Skinner box, right? Even pigeons, which are not very smart, right? If they know, if they step on one lever, they get a shock. If they step on another lever, they get a piece of corn. Even a dumb pigeon eventually steps on the lever that gives him corn. Now, if Hashem created a world where goodness would be immediately rewarded and evil would be immediately punished, my choice of doing good would not be a virtuous choice. It would simply be a mechanical, expedient choice. Now, you may ask a question, well, why does Hashem want free will? Why not have a world where people are conditioned to choose good? The answer is, in many ways, the Chavos Levavos tells us this, evil is necessary for goodness to be truly good. In other words, imagine if you were God, let's imagine that you're a systems engineer and you're trying to organize a universe where there is the potential for the greatest righteousness and holiness that can exist. You would have to build in the idea that evil sometimes prospers in the world. Because if you took that out, you've limited the capacity for true goodness, because then goodness would be a matter of expediency and convenience, and goodness that is a matter of convenience and expediency is not really good. So to make good really good, you have to have a world where bad guys sometimes win, where righteous people sometimes suffer. So when a person chooses to serve God, they're choosing to serve God, at least among the highest tzaddikim, because they love Hashem and they have faith in Him and they're willing to do this. Now, this is why, precisely, why it may sometimes be the most righteous who suffer. Because for the people who are not necessarily on the madrega, for the people who would rebel against Hashem if they had suffering, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu might say, I'll leave them in a relatively comfortable state, so at least they'll serve me at a lower level instead of serving me at a higher level. But the tzaddik, who can serve Hashem at the higher level, Hashem might bedafka put him on that higher level. So in a complicated way, you almost have a situation where often the tzaddikim are going to get the toughest end of the deal because they are capable of goodness at the highest level. Now, Rishayim prosper, the same idea. If Rishayim wouldn't prosper, then, you know, the choice of being righteous would be convenience motivated and not virtue motivated. So, I understand emotionally this may not answer all of those things, but this does create the idea that evil is a necessary component of the maximization of goodness and righteousness and Kedusha. And this is really the point of the book of Job, the book of Eev, at the very end. If you remember the book of Eev, Eev is a righteous man, he's a tzaddik, but he's wealthy, he's well respected, he has a family, he has a lot of children, he's personally healthy. And then we read that the Satan makes a bet with Hashem, saying, oh, I bet you if you let me take all these things away, he's not going to be so righteous. And Hashem accepts the bet, and all of a sudden, unbeknownst to Eve, Eve is not aware of this conversation, all of these things happen to him. And there's no particular reason. If you read the book, it seems to be Hashem made a bet with the Satan, like Hashem didn't know. But the truth of the matter is, there's something much deeper. Again, the book of Eve deserves a whole course on its own. But the basic message is, the Satan is not some bad guy, really. The Satan has a respected role in God's heavenly courts. The Satan is not, as in the Christian tradition, an angel that is thrown out of heaven.
Lucifer.
Right. The Satan is in the heavenly court. He's literally the prosecutor. That's what Satan means. And his job is to try to bring a sense of justice into the world. No freebies. And his argument is, Hashem, if you want Eve to be a righteous person to the highest level, you must give him hardships, because if all he does is constantly get rewarded for the good that he's done, he has not become the tzaddik that he could have become. The Satan is making a real point here. They tell the story with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was once asked about why people sometimes suffer, why there's so many poor people in Brisk, etc. So he once said that wealth can sometimes be like very sharp knives, very, very sharp knives. And if people don't know how to handle it in a good way, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is moneah from them so they can serve Hashem at their level and not be exposed to the nisayon of dealing with sharp knives. But then somebody asked him, yeah, but there was a man in Brisk who was a great, great tzaddik. He was very wealthy. And he gave money to tzedakah and he started yeshivas and he was kavei itim l'torah. And then he lost all of his fortune. But surely such a man knew how to serve Hashem with his wealth. Why is he spending his last years in such abject poverty? They didn't understand. That didn't fit Rav Chaim's explanation that if you don't get wealth, it's because maybe it's too dangerous a tool for you. And Rav Chaim said, I have another explanation for this. And my explanation is that sometimes a person goes to school for many years and he becomes an expert in a given field. But then when he wants to go to another field, he has to go to school again. Like a person might finish medical school, and then he may want to go to law school. I used to teach law. I actually had doctors. They often go because they were sued in malpractice, and they want to know what those rules are. Of course, in a comic strip, I remember years ago, there was a whole thing where somebody was a perpetual student. He didn't want to enter the working world. So he went through every PhD program in the university, and he was really panicking because he reached the end of the rope. You know, after a certain number of years, he got every doctorate the school had. He didn't know what to do next. But be it as may, Rav Chaim says, life is that way as well. There is a college of hard knocks, the school of hard knocks, that teaches you how to serve Hashem with deprivation and suffering. And then there is the school of wealth, which is also a nisayon. How do you serve Hashem with your wealth? By not getting too involved in Olam Hazeh. By using your wealth for tzedakah and ma'asim tovim, by not becoming a hedonist and a bal taiva. And sometimes the way Hashem works is, once a person has mastered one degree, Hashem says, okay, you've mastered that. I want you to master the other way as well. Rav Chaim said, this individual mastered serving Hashem with Ashiras. And out of Hashem's love for him, Hashem says, now I want you to be mashlim your neshama in a different way. Of course, one might argue that had the order been reversed, it may have been a little more pleasant, you know, first be poor. But nevertheless, Rav Chaim says, that's the hashgacha. That's the gamzul atova. Hashem says, there are so many different ways, so many kochos in your neshama, so many abilities in your neshama. And when Hashem loves a person, he wants to give him all of the different ways of shlemus. Yeah.
In order to appreciate a state of being in life, you have to have contrasting. If everything is dark, you get used to the dark. If you're sitting in a dark room hours and days,
right,
it starts to seem a little lighter.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if you bring light in, you realize how dark it was. And
right.
Also, if you have only good in your life,
mm-hmm.
That's very true. You need contrast.
Yeah, Yisrael, that's what the Svarim say. Yisrael ha'or min ha'cheshech. The superiority of light is from the awareness of darkness. Yeah, that's very true. So the Chovas Halevavos is telling us, in other words, that evil and hardship befall even the righteous because that enables them to choose to serve Hashem out of commitment and not out of convenience and expediency. And that makes them holier, that makes them greater, that makes them closer to Hashem than if you had a world where goodness was always rewarded and evil was always prospered. Now, this point is actually made in another way by Dr. Viktor Frankl. You may have read his books over the years. He died recently. He was a Jewish psychotherapist who was totally assimilated. He never had any Jewish education whatsoever, but he had a deep spiritual consciousness, and out of his experiences in concentration camps, he developed a school of thought called logotherapy, which really mirrors very, very much the ideas of Torah, and it's considered to be, you know, I won't call it a work of Torah literature, but it's certainly a very eloquent and beautiful work, Man's Search for Meaning, which echoes and articulates ideas that are from the Torah coming out of his own experiences. And logotherapy is based on the idea that the most deep-seated urge in a human being is not biological, but is to seek a meaning and purpose in his existence. And often that meaning and purpose can be found precisely in our struggle against the difficulties that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us. He said that a human being may have very little choice over what happens to him in life, whether it's health or sickness. This is what Chazal say, HaKol Bidei Shamayim. But the one choice that can never be taken away from us is how we choose to respond to what was put into our lives. Right? We can choose to respond with nobility, with transcendence, with selflessness, with compassion, with love, or we can choose to become bitter and broken. And that is our choice. And that even the Nazis could not take away from a Jew. Well, that's the Hishtadlut. The Hishtadlut is to have the equanimity of spirits, to understand that this is not going to break me, to understand that I don't know why things happen to me, but I choose how to respond. By the way, this doesn't have to be, you know, cosmic things like the Holocaust. This could be even the small frustrations of everyday life. You know, your child breaks a glass or whatever it is. So once again, we might get angry, we might get impatient, but we can always step back from the situation. In fact, it's brought down by the Bali Musar that sometimes you have to work on small things in order to be prepared for the big things. The person who works on how to view spilt milk in perspective will be prepared when real rough things come down the pike. Because they have the tools, they've developed the skills, they've brought out the kochos hanefesh that can deal with these problems. That's why you'll find in Musar Vadim and the like, both for men and women, they often talk about trivial problems. They don't talk about, in fact, they even have a rule in some of these Vadim. We're not allowed to talk about serious illness or death. We talk about messy rooms, we talk about kids not getting up on time, and homework not being done, or whatever it is. We talk about small things. Well, you figure, gee, you're having a mushravad with a chashav, a rav, or a rebbetzin, shouldn't we talk about big, important crises in life? The answer is no. Just like in, you know, weightlifting or something, you know, if you want to lift weight, you're not going to start with a, you know, 10,000 pound weight. Got to start small, and that builds up strength. In spiritual matters too, you start small. So, of course, the Yidden in the Holocaust didn't always have the chance to start small. They kind of jumped into this difficult, tragic situation. But Frankl mentions he knew people before the war who he would not have regarded as righteous people. These were regular people. Nobody was special in particular. But in the course of the concentration camps, they became very holy. They risked their lives to bring bread and medicine to people who needed it. They were transformed. In other words, had they not had that encounter with evil, their lives just would have been parif. It just would have been. So, in the book of Iyov, there's a marvelous metaphor. He talks about evil as the disgusting fertilizer that causes flowers to grow. Right? Fertilizer is manure. Fertilizer is disgusting. And yet, it's precisely, this is in the book of Iyov, this is Mamish the Zevel, this is Mamish the Mashal that Iyov uses in describing evil in the world. Evil is filthy and disgusting and awful. But it's precisely that confrontation that can bring out kochos and potentials and goodness and resilience and courage and hope that otherwise just would have been dormant. They were always in you, but they had no occasion to come out. So in many, many ways, Chavis Lubavitch makes this point, again, I'm bringing in other things, that the evil in the world is part of the plan to bring out powers within a person that would otherwise never come out. You know, if life would just be without those challenges, we would not have developed. I'm sorry.
And yet we say,
well, here's the thing. We ask Hashem not to put us in a nisoyon, Because, you know, there's an old saying that's true. Hashem never gives you a nisayon that you cannot pass. That's a true statement. But I would add another statement. Hashem never gives you a guaranteed pass either. Meaning to say, every nisayon, I have the koach to pass it. But Hashem is not going to give me a nisayon that's so easy that it's a guaranteed pass. That's like a teacher giving a test. It wouldn't make sense for a teacher to give a test where ahead of time, it's announced every student's going to get an A. If every student's going to get an A, then why give the test? Okay? So, in every nisayon, I might not be strong enough. So I ask Hashem, don't give me the challenge. But if it comes, person has to know, I can do it. I can do it. Even if it looks insurmountable, I can do it. Chanukah, one day oil. You'll light it. It burns for 8 days. Hashem will give you the koach. So let me tell you a little story, not even from a religious person, but it's a very, very beautiful story. There is a musician in Baltimore, Leon Fleischer, who some of you may know of. In the 60s and 70s, he was one of the world's greatest classic pianists. Obsessive, I guess every classical musician must be fairly obsessive, but because he was practicing hours and hours and hours a day, so in the late 70s, early 80s, he developed some severe repetitive stress injuries in the fingers of his right hand. So basically, he was not able to continue playing anymore. And for a person of his caliber, this took away his whole meaning in life. He wanted to die. He wanted to commit suicide. He saw no reason to live anymore. He tried every treatment that was available throughout the world. They really didn't help. For a while, he was doing left-handed pieces. I think there's a certain number of left-handed pieces in the classical repertoire, but you know, you run out of those fairly quickly. Finally, having no other option, he decided to devote his talents to teaching other people. He became one of the great teachers in the world, and many people who later became very prominent in classical music were his disciples. And in a sense, he lived vicariously through the Talmidim that he produced and through all of the accolades and awards that they got. A few years ago, there was something discovered in Japan, some deep tissue massage, which some people thought had hope for these types of carpal tunnel. And some of his friends, I think his wife, urged him, why don't you consider this? And he didn't even want to open that box because he had been through so many disappointments. His hope had been raised so many times that he thought, I'm happy now, I'm a teacher now, I don't want to get into it. But eventually they prevailed upon him. And lo and behold, a miracle happened. That after being disabled for more than 20 years, he was able to play again. Although I understand there may have been a recurrence, but for a while he was actually able to play again. And because he had been teaching all those years, his talent had not atrophied so much, and he was able to play at a very, very high level. Beautiful story, happy ending. But listen to what he said. He's he's a Jewish man, but he's not a formally religious man. He's not a frum person. But he said the following. He said, this was his perspective. All the years that I was a successful musician, it was all about me. I reveled in the glory. I reveled in the recognition. I reveled in the applause and the accolades. And God wanted to teach me to care more about others, to give to others, to rejoice in their successes, and not to look at my glory as the end all and the be all. So he took away my talents. He took away my talents. So I would learn to focus on other people, to care about other people, to let them get the applause. And he says, and when I learned to care more about other people than I cared about my own success, Hashem said, or God said, you learned your lesson, you can have it back now. This is exactly what Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said. There are different schools in life that teach us different things. And sometimes a person might master one school of life. But Hashem says, I'm going to send you to another school. So you'll learn something new. You'll learn something better. You'll learn something deeper. And when you've graduated from that school, you can go back to your old profession. That's okay. But I wanted you to have the journey of learning something else. Again, you know, it's an amazing, sometimes it's fairly amazing that whether it's Viktor Frankl or Leon Fleischer, people who did not have a formal education in Torah, but because of their neshama, which is a chelek eloka mimal, coming from God, the pinchel yid, so to speak, there's a certain aspect of life and ruchnius and truth that one can intuit from the deep recesses of their neshama. And I'm perfectly, you know, I'm not embarrassed to use these secular sources, so to speak, because I think they do communicate truth that is deeply spiritual truth, and that is exactly what the Chovas Halevavos teaches us, what Rav Chaim teaches us, and the like. And once again, in Fleischer's case, we did have the happy ending after many years. Sometimes we don't have the happy ending, so to speak, in that way. But nevertheless, it's always going to be true that we can never really ask the question, why does Hashem do something to us? But we can ask a more meaningful question, how do I respond to what Hashem has put in my life? As Rav Soloveitchik used to say, Judaism does not like to ask theological questions. It likes to ask halachic questions. Now, by that he means the following. Theology is asking why God behaves a certain way. Halacha asks, what do I do in any given situation? So Rav Soloveitchik used to suggest that theodicy, which is just a fancy word for why do good things happen to bad people, or the other way, bad things happen to good people, theodicy should be approached not as a matter of theology, it should be approached as a matter of halacha. Meaning, what do I do? This is my matzav. What do I do? How can I grow from this situation? And as they say, the beauty of this is, this applies to big things and it applies to small things. And as the Bali Musar say, we got to start with small things and then we'll be ready for the big things. Okay? So, once again, these are ideas to think about. The idea of evil as a transformative vehicle for good. Certainly, like the Chovas Halevavos, you're forced to say that, because the Chovas Halevavos says everything that happens to me is from God, but even like the Orach Chaim, where things might be a little more difficult, but even like the Orach Chaim, who says that a lot of evil is the fallout of people's bechira, but we still have to concede that Hashem is allowing it to happen, because that's a minimum case. And if Hashem is allowing it to happen, there's also a Gamzul L'Tova in that aspect as well. So this is a perspective to think about. Now, let me just end with one final thought about Hanukkah. And that is, I've said it before, but it's worthwhile to think about again. Hanukkah is, of course, and I know that Rivki was talking about this as well, Hanukkah, of course, is the idea of the light that dispels the darkness, the or that is Docha, the Choshech. In fact, not counting the Shamash, there are 36 Hanukkah candles that you light, you know, 1 through 8, 36. And in the Sifrei Kabbalah it says that the 36 candles of Hanukkah correspond to the 36 hours of the divine light that enlightened the world for the first 3 days of creation, 12 hours a day, until the sun was created on day 4. And once the sun was created, the special divine light was concealed for the tzaddikim. And this is called Or HaGanuz, the 36 hours of hidden lights we can recapture and re-experience in the 36 candles of Hanukkah. Yeah.
Does this have anything to do with the 36
tzaddikim? It would be connected, that's correct. Yeah, that's correct. 36 is connected. They're hidden. They represent in physical human form the hidden light of Hashem. By the way, just as a little aside, I'll get back to the Hanukkah thing in a moment, just a little aside, somebody once said at the time of the Vilna Gaon that they were convinced that the Vilna Gaon was one of the 36 hidden tzaddikim. So someone said to him, what are you talking about? The Vilna Gaon is like the most famous gadol in the world. What do you mean the hidden tzaddik? He says, you should know that as famous as he is, nobody really knows the depths of his tzidkus. You could be famous and be a hidden tzaddik because people see only the tiniest tip of the iceberg. He says, he is so great that with all of his piercing, he is one of the hidden tzaddikim of the world. But be it as it may, that's what Chanukah is. The Chanukah is the light of Hashem that pierces the darkness. But there's an important lesson for us as well. Because darkness exists on many, many levels. There is the darkness of oppression. There is the darkness of murder, of violence, of corruption, of tumah. There is the darkness within a person of depression, of not feeling I'm accomplishing, the darkness of loneliness, the darkness of illness. Right, there is darkness within a person, there is darkness outside of a person. And sometimes when we confront the darkness in our lives, in our collective lives, our individual lives, we feel that there's very little that we can do. The darkness is so overpowering that our capacity to light something that will dispel that darkness is so minimal, it's so insignificant. Why bother to even try? And the message of Chanukah is that that was exactly the way the Jews faced. Number one, in the war against Yavan, what's the use of fighting against this most powerful army in the world, which it was? And indeed, with the Chanukah menorah itself, like, you know, we're not going to be able to get more oil for another 8 days. What's the use of lighting one day? It's just going to go out. Why bother to start something that's not going to pan out, it's not going to finish, it's not going to accomplish? Why bother to even start? And the lesson of Chanukah is that every Jew has the power to have light that dispels the darkness. And if you do what you're able to do, even if it seems meaningless and ineffectual, Hashem will give you a bracha that will transcend its natural limitations. That is the immensely important idea of Chanukah. To have faith in yourself, to understand that no matter how insignificant you think your efforts are, a yid was given by the Bore a capacity to create light, and even if b'derech hateva it seems that that will do nothing, you do what you can, then Hashem opens the doors. If they would have decided not to light the menorah for one day, if they would have decided not to look for anything. You have to understand, they walk into the Beis HaMikdash. Do you know how many years the Beis HaMikdash had been in control of the Yavanim for 3 years? 3 years! By the way, it's fascinating. It's Miyom Liyom. The Yavanim entered the Beis HaMikdash the 25th of Kislev. That's when they contaminated the Beis HaMikdash. 3 years later, on the 25th of Kislev, we entered. 188 BCE to 185 BCE. And what did the Yavanim do? They put up idols, they sacrificed pigs on the altar, they put up houses of prostitution in the holiest places. And the Jews come in, and all they see is rubble, destruction, contamination. Why would they even bother to look for oil? You know, in the rubble somewhere, what are they going through? And if they wouldn't have done that, there wouldn't have been a miracle. So what does Chanukah say? Do what you can, whenever you can. And then Hashem takes over. But only if you do what you can. If you don't do what you can, nothing happens. So Chanukah is, on one hand, about gratitude to Hashem. But it's also about the responsibility we have to light our light, to dispel that darkness. You know, they tell a story about... like these stories often go, about a king that had a tower that was 1,000 stories, and he said, whoever can climb to the top of the tower gets to marry my daughter. In these stories, the daughter is often not consulted, but these are how the stories go. 1,000 stories. So most people said, well, I can't do 1,000 stories, so what's the purpose? But there was a fellow, well, I can't do 1,000 stories, I can do something, I'll do what I can. He goes up 5 stories, 10 stories already, even before that, you know, a little out of breath. He keeps, so they're laughing at him, oh, another 990 stories. So he does 20 stories, well, you know, 25, 30. I mean, what's the point here? This is idiotic, you know. Whatever he does, and there was a deadline, he had to finish by sunset. Whatever he does is going to be a tipa min hayam. But he says, I'll do what I can do. We'll see. And the story goes, when he got to the 50th story, where he was on the verge of collapse, the platform turned into an express elevator and took him to the top. And again, that's also a good mashal. You know, our efforts are never going to be commensurate to truly do the job. So as a result, we figure, why bother to start? But the thing that we make the mistake is that ultimately it's not our efforts that are going to get the job done anyway. But by the hishtaglus we put in, Hashem puts a bracha. That's what Chanukah is. You light one day, and then Hashem gives you 8 days. If you don't light the one day, you don't get anything.
So maybe that's another reason why we have the candles of 8 days.
That they look. That,
days.
That's correct. That's correct. The first day was the nace that we looked. Yeah. Now, I just mentioned Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, who had been for Rashi of Eretz Yisrael, and then an apparent demotion after he retired, Rav Rashi of Tel Aviv. Well, the Tel Aviv job's probably harder than Rav Rashi of Eretz Yisrael. Has a very interesting story. You know, he was a child in the concentration camp, and he was protected by his older brother. If the Nazis would have discovered him at any time, they would have killed him immediately, because you didn't have little kids in concentration camps. And his brother used to keep him in a bag, in a sack of potatoes, like whatever it is, schlep him around. Just an amazing story. It was for over a year like that. And Rabbi Lau used to say that it was a great, great miracle that they never looked in the bag, because if they looked, they would have found. So he made the point, by Chanukah, the miracle was they looked. Sometimes there's a miracle when they don't look. So either way, it's a miracle. So I wish you all a very, very happy and joyous Chanukah, and may it be a rededication for all of us.